Recorded live.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Pastor Eli James here, along with Pastor William Fink. We have another installment of Christogenos. Today is Friday, August 6, 2010, and the heat wave has finally ended here in Chicago, although now it's time for allergy season, which has, hopefully you can understand me. I've been having a sinus congestion for the last week or so, although it seems to be getting better today. So how are you, Bill?
Wonderful. Praise Yahweh.
Yeah, praise Yahweh. Okay, so last week we ended in the middle of chapter 16 of Ezekiel, and let me just read the last verse that we ended on last time, and maybe you could recap what we've covered in this chapter so far. You are your mother's daughter that loathes her husband and her children, and you are the sister of your sisters which loathe their husbands and their children. Your mother was a Hittite, and your father an Amorite. So what is this chapter about? What's this? Because this phrase has been repeated a couple of times.
Well, this shows when David took Jerusalem, he never really drove out all of the Jebusite Canaanite people.
Right.
Okay, and that's a matter of record.
Yeah.
And he even bought the threshing floor of the Canaanite in order to build it for a place for the temple.
Right.
Now, this is telling the same story that basically Jeremiah chapter 2 is telling, where Jeremiah says that these people are basically Yahweh planted a pleasant plant, and it became, and it was a noble vine, a holy right seed, and it turned into the degenerate plant of a strange vine.
Right.
And Jeremiah says, Yahweh says through Jeremiah of that plant that though it washes itself with soap, it can't wash off its sin.
That's right.
And that's the only sin that can't be washed off, it can't be cleansed, is race mixing.
Right.
That's the unpardonable sin.
The soap doesn't get into the DNA.
Well, it can't be cleansed. There's no way it can be cleansed.
It can't be cleansed.
And that is the only, a pleasant plant that becomes a strange vine, coupled with a sin that can't be washed off, which Jeremiah says of the people of Jerusalem.
Yes.
And they're not all like that, of course, but evidently a great number of them are.
Right.
And then coupled with the Ezekiel statement here, And now we see why the Son of Man, and this is Ezekiel 11:15, Son of Man, thy brethren, even thy brethren, the men of thy kindred, and the whole house of Israel, unto they are to whom the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and the inhabitants of Jerusalem, these Mamzer people, have said, get you far from Yahweh, unto us this land is given in possession.
Right.
And then, therefore, we have the Jews.
That's right. That's right.
They're the only ones that fulfilled that.
Right.
And we'll see that to a further extent in Ezekiel chapters 35 and 36.
Right.
But it's absolutely clear here that it's the Canaanites and the Amorites who were trying at this time to abscond Judah's inheritance.
Right, right. And even after the return from Babylon, Ezra and Nehemiah were so agitated by the race mixing that had been going on and was still going on among the priests, that they had to abolish that and threaten every male who maintained a non-Israelite wife and half-breed children. You either get rid of those children or you leave. Your wife and children, or you leave. You can't be a member.
Well, right. And unfortunately, a lot of the history in between the time of Ezra and the time of the Maccabees is missing.
Right.
And in fact, just about all of it's missing.
Yeah.
It's not in Josephus. It's not in the apocryphal books, that there's a few of the prophets were in the intertestamental period, but they were close to the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, like Malachi and Zechariah. By 150 BC, according to Josephus, right shortly after the time of the Maccabees, or by 130 BC, we see a party arise that calls themselves Pharisees.
Right.
And I believe, I can't prove it, but because the word means separatist, I think that they started out with noble intentions.
Probably, yeah. Just like the Republican Party.
Well, absolutely.
Started out with noble intentions.
Absolutely.
Right. Okay, and look at them today.
all political parties, well, not all of them, but most of them of our people start out with noble intentions.
That's right.
And the money comes in, and the backroom deals get made,
yeah.
And somebody gets screwed, and the party becomes corrupted.
And look, we've got another female Jewish Supreme Court justice in the works.
What is it with the first black president? The only thing you could find for Supreme Court justice candidates are Jewish female lesbians.
That's right. That's right.
What's up with that? Don't people see a pattern there?
Exactly. They're the ones that are giving all the money behind the scenes, right? Here, Mr. Rothschild, Obama needs more money. Sure thing. We'll just print some up, right? That's how they financed Obama from the beginning. CIA.
Well, that leads me to talk about the rest of this chapter. And you know, here we see in Ezekiel 16, we see a perfect reflection of the social, political, and religious climate with today. This is us.
Yes.
This is us 2,700, well, 2,600 years ago. And Judea had come very much like we see today with the idolatry of the children of Israel,
yes,
causing the children of Israel to become nothing but whores,
yes,
for all of the surrounding peoples.
Yes.
And Ezekiel at 16:25 here, he even uses a phrase which means spread thy legs to everyone that passes by.
Right.
And he uses that in conjunction with the phrase multiply thy whoredoms in describing Israel's relationships,
yeah,
with the surrounding heathen peoples.
That's right, that's right.
And then Ezekiel explains how while typically whores receive gifts from their consort, Israel does even worse by playing the whore and giving out gifts to her.
Right. Yeah, we're giving
that describes our foreign policy and our domestic policy with these illegal aliens to it. Perfect. It's
that's
perfect.
Right.
It's a perfect description of what we're doing today. And here in Ezekiel 16,
yeah,
the prophet lays out circumstances to which we also, yeah, see an exact parallel prophecy by Christ in the Revelation in chapters 17 and 18.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Where Israel is again depicted as the whore in much the same way.
Right, yeah. In a very self-destructive, you know, ethnic white guilt fashion, we are giving away the store. We're giving everything that we've ever created.
And when you compare this with the Revelation, you'll know that there's no other people than the Anglo-Germanic nations that could possibly fit this description today.
Yeah.
We are the whore,
right,
and therefore, because we are Christians and we are the whore, we are the people of the Old Testament, too.
That's right.
And the Jews are the serpent, and the one-world Babylonian political, religious, and economic system that the Jews have set up is the beast. The image of the beast is the image of the Jews, and all of these mams are peoples whom Christians worship today.
That's right. That's right. They're worshiping the beast, and they know it not. It's because Jesus even told those people, We prophesied, we healed in your name. And he says, I know you not, depart from me, okay? Because these people do not know the true Jesus. They only know a Jesus of their own imagination, okay? So let's go back into Ezekiel 16, verse 46. And your elders...
Well, 45, I think we should...
Well, no, I just covered 45.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah. I thought...
Oh, okay, I'm sorry, I didn't even read it. I'm an idiot.
Verse 46, and your elder sister is Samaria, she and her daughters that dwell at your left hand, and your younger sister that dwells at your right hand is Sodom and her daughters.
Now, let me explain something. Well, first, in this mother-daughter, you know, we could look back from ancient Israel to the more ancient Babel, or from Anglo-German Israel today to ancient Israel and see a mother-daughter relationship. Where we actually descended from those people, and our mother was corrupt, and so are we, the
yes,
daughter. Daughter is used, that mother-daughter relationship is used often in the prophets of nations,
yes,
and their colonies.
Right.
But more so, I'd like to say that this again describes the infiltration of Judah by the Canaanites, and here Israel is Samaria, and Judah is Sodom.
Right.
And yeah, remember that half of Jerusalem is actually Benjamin.
Right.
Half of Jerusalem was in Benjamin's territory and technically Israel, right? And,
right,
and not Judah. And here, Jerusalem, there's three parties we're going to see described here in a parable. That there's the figure being addressed, and then there's her sisters the younger sister and the older sister, Samaria and Sodom. And I read this parable that Samaria is the northern 10 tribes taken away by the Assyrians.
Right.
But Sodom is Judah, the 46 fenced cities, most of Judah, also taken away by the Assyrians.
Yes.
And now we have left, we have Jerusalem. So there's three parties in this parable, as we'll see as you read on.
Yes, and as we found out in Isaiah, just the people in Jerusalem were the only ones, the only Israelites left in all of Judea. Everybody else was either killed or taken captive.
Well, by this time, definitely, yes.
Yes, I forget, was it 200,000 people that were still in Jerusalem at that time, taken captive? Do you remember? Because it's only like 40,000 actually returned.
Well, only 40,000 returned. I don't know if we know how many were taken captive.
Okay.
What we do know that it can be told that the city can hold up to 2 million people.
Okay.
At its glory.
Right.
And that's a pretty big city.
Right.
Now, a lot of the remnant, there's some Israelites left behind in Samaria and other places. The Assyrians didn't get everybody.
Right.
There's the poor of the land that were left behind. It's
right.
spoken of, but it's very few. It's a smattering of people that managed to escape the captivity.
Right.
As far as Jerusalem's concerned, a lot of Israel did flee into Jerusalem also to escape the Assyrians.
Right, right, yeah. So Jerusalem would have been bursting at the seams probably from people fleeing from the Assyrians, yeah. Okay.
Well, I'm sure, and that's record's clear in the scripture when we read Chronicles and Kings.
Right, okay, yeah, very good. All right, verse 48. And, let me see, 47. Yet have you not walked after their ways, nor done after their abominations, but as if that were a very little thing, you were corrupted more than they in all your ways. So what was this saying that they...
Well, the people of Jerusalem are much more corrupt than either the deported Israelites or deported Judah.
Right. Okay. Verse 48, as I live, says Yahweh Elohim, Sodom, your sister, has not done, she nor her daughters, as you have done, you and your daughters. Well, what do you think? Is there any evidence that the Levitical priesthood, which was still in operation in Jerusalem at this point, did they pervert the temple by allowing non-Israelites into it? Any evidence for that? Because from my understanding in Josephus, the first evidence of that, aside from the fact that the Greeks invaded, okay, Antiochus Epiphanes invaded and ransacked the temple and slaughtered a pig on the altar. But the Maccabees were able to drive him out and clean that up. Have you come across any evidence that the Levitical priesthood had become corrupted by this time?
Well, you know, there's no historical evidence, I don't think, in the books that explicitly mentions
okay.
the folding in of strangers outside of the prophets.
Okay.
However, there are clear historical references that there were for long periods of time, the book of the laws was actually set aside.
Okay.
And it was actually lost at one time.
Right.
I mean, just totally neglected. And we see that in Chronicles and in Kings. I believe it's of the time of Joash, where the book of the law was found and read to the people. And it's worded in a way that it hadn't been read in years
right.
to the people. It seems that way when we read the accounts in Kings.
Is it true that in the modern Judeo-Christian churches, they don't read the book of the Word?
Well no, they don't.
The Old Testament.
And we evidently have the same pattern going on then.
That's right. Okay, verse 49. Behold, this was the iniquity of your sister Sodom, pride, fullness of bread, and abundance of idleness was in her and in her daughters. Neither did she strengthen the hand of the poor and needy. So greedy, self-absorbed Israelites, just like we have today. And whenever you have that type of Israelite, Jews happen, right? The Jews come along to exploit the greedy tendencies that we have in us and the idol worship, because we can, you know, we fill football and baseball stadiums with hundreds of thousands of people, and then if the, you know, that has taken the place of church for a lot of people, okay, And so, and even if they do go to church, it's the wrong type of church, and they don't learn any religion, all right? They learn idolatry, more idolatry, yes.
I would like to read this, and I'm reading from 2 Chronicles 34:12.
Okay.
And when they brought out the money that was brought into the house of Yahweh, Hilkiah the priest found a book of the law of Yahweh given by Moses.
Uh-huh.
And Hilkiah the priest answered and said to Shaphan the scribe, I have found the book of the law in the house of Yahweh.
Wow, look
like,
at you.
Hey, look at this.
Yeah, right.
I found this relic.
Yeah, right.
And that's really what it sounds like.
Yeah, what are we supposed to do with this?
Well, yes.
Yeah. We're supposed to follow this?
And it came to pass when the king had heard the words of the law that he has rent his clothes.
Yeah.
Because it was read before the king. And in other words, he must not have heard it in a long time.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. At least he was righteous. It upset him that it hadn't been.
Well, we're right. And that's 2 Chronicles chapter 34.
Okay, very good. All right, verse 50. And they were haughty and committed abomination before me. Therefore I took them away as I saw good. Neither. Now, this word good is in italics. And there's other words that have been added here in the King James. And I took them away as I saw. I don't think the word good needs to be there. It doesn't really add anything.
Therefore, well, let me get.
50,
I went off my page, right?
Verse 50.
And they boasted and wrought iniquities before me, so I cut them off as I saw. And then fit is added.
Saw fit would be the proper word to add, yes. Okay, very good. Verse 51. Neither has Samaria committed half of your sins, but you have multiplied your abominations more than they, and have justified your sisters in all your abominations which you have done. In other words, you made them look pale in the unrighteous conduct compared to what you have done here, you house of Judah. Verse 52, you also, which have judged your sisters, bear your own shame for your sins that you have committed before, committed more abominable than they. They are more righteous than you. Yea, be you confounded also, and bear your shame in that you have justified your sisters.
So this proves out what I was saying, that this is indeed a parable, and here we see Jerusalem as an entity contrasted to both Israel and Judah.
Right.
And both of them were already long taken away by the Assyrians.
Right, right. Okay, verse 53. When I shall bring again their captivity, the captivity of Sodom and her daughters, and the captivity of Samaria and her daughters, then will I bring again the captivity of your captives in the midst of them. Okay, so are we talking specifically here the Babylonian captivity? Because the...
this is the Babylonian captivity that's contrasted to the captivities of the Assyrians.
Right, but it's not a reference to a future captivity.
Well, the only future captivity is that of Jerusalem, right? Well, which
right.
is actually has a few years yet.
Right, yeah, it's a few years before it actually happens. But
well, we'll see in Jeremiah. I'm sorry, in Ezekiel chapter 20, he dates himself again. And he says, in the seventh year. Now, he began in the fifth year of Jehoiakim's captivity,
uh-huh.
which was the fifth year also of Zedekiah's reign. And Zedekiah reigned 11 years before Jerusalem was destroyed for good.
Uh-huh.
So we have 6 years left at that time. Well, it's the seventh year of Jehoiakim's captivity when chapter 20 begins. So we're
okay.
in that period somewhere.
Okay, so it's getting ready to happen. The captivity of Jerusalem is getting ready to happen. Verse 54, that you may bear your own shame and may be confounded in all that you have done, and that you are a comfort to them. When your sister Sodom and her daughters shall return to their former estate, and Samaria and her daughter shall return to their former estate, then you and your daughters shall return to your former estate.
Now that sort of, you know, that doesn't seem like really a promise to me as much as it does a threat concerning the bad figs and the Mamzers in Jerusalem.
Yeah.
And it seems that way. But here I also have to say that it's fully evident that we cannot, as certain clowns do, I won't mention Troublemaker's name, confuse what later came out of Jerusalem,
yeah.
namely the bad figs, with those of true Judah already long ago taken by the Assyrians.
Uh-huh.
They're definitely distinguished here.
Yes.
The people of Jerusalem with Judah that had already been deported.
Right, right. Okay. Verse 56, for your sister Sodom was not mentioned by your mouth in the day of your pride, before your wickedness was discovered, as at the time of your reproach of the daughters of Syria, and all that are round about her, the daughters of the Philistines, which despise you round about. You have borne your lewdness and your abominations, says Yahweh. For thus says Yahweh Elohim, I will even deal with you as you have done, which have despised the oath in breaking the covenant.
Now this is actually not going to, there's a covenant spoken of. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, there is a covenant here that's the new covenant, that's the old covenant, and there's a promise of the new covenant.
Okay.
But there's a covenant later on that we'll see is simply refers to the covenant between Zedekiah and the book of Nezar. I'm sorry.
Okay. All right. This,
getting ahead of myself.
Right. Now, this seems to be a reference to the oath at Sinai, the covenant at Sinai, which, of course, both Israel and Judah have abundantly broken by this time.
Well, absolutely.
Yes.
And this next verse, verse 60, is the covenant, is a new covenant promise in Ezekiel and a witness to Jeremiah 31:31.
Okay. Verse 60, then. Nevertheless, I will remember my covenant with you in the days of your youth. In other words, he, Yahweh, will remain true, because Yahweh never breaks his promises, in the day with you in the days of your youth, and I will establish to you an everlasting covenant. Okay, yes, this definitely parallels Jeremiah 31:31. Verse 61, then you shall remember your ways and be ashamed when you shall receive your sisters, your elder, and your younger, and I will give them to you for daughters, but not by your covenant, and I will establish my covenant with you, and you shall know that I am Yahweh, that you may remember and be confounded and never open your mouth any more because of your shame, when I am pacified toward you for all that you have done, says Yahweh Elohim. Now, he was briefly pacified, and obviously after the return from Babylon, there was a golden age of law-keeping under Ezra and Nehemiah, and the Maccabees did their utmost to stay separate, to remain a separate and distinct ethnicity practicing. You know, the Israelites were the only people on the planet practicing Yahweh's religion. Okay? Some of the Canaanites invoked the name of Yahweh, but they also invoked the name of all other gods as well. Okay?
Well, right. And that, we see that in many nations, that nations want to... That the heathens would believe that the more gods that they worshipped, the better chance that they had that one of them would be true.
Right.
So they adopted everybody's gods.
It's a crapshoot.
And even the Romans did that later.
Right.
I mean, they got into not only Mithraism, but Isis and all the gods of Egypt, and every god they conquered, they brought back to Rome and worshipped.
Today it's called diversifying your portfolio.
Well, today it's called, right, but today it's really called ecumenicalism, right?
Right, ecumenism, right. Very good. Chapter 17, verse 1. And the word of Yahweh came to me, saying, Son of man, put forth a riddle, and speak a parable to the house of Israel, and say, Thus says Yahweh Elohim, a great eagle with great wings, long-winged, full of feathers, which had diverse colors, came to Lebanon and took the highest branch of the cedar. This is a good parable. He cropped off the top of its young twigs and carried it into a land of traffic. He set it in a city of merchants. Any comments up to this point?
Well, right. There's a couple of eagles here, and
yes,
there's a couple of twigs.
Yes.
And this twig is not the princesses of Zedekiah. We're going to get into that a little later in this chapter.
Yeah.
This eagle is Nebuchadnezzar,
okay,
who carried the king Jehoiakim of Judah off into captivity,
uh-huh,
set his brother Zedekiah in his place.
Right.
Okay. And set Jehoiakim in Babylon.
Right.
Okay. And we'll see that this is the Babylonian captivity after you cover verse 6.
Yeah.
Because it talks about the way it became a vine and brought forth branches,
right,
and shot forth wings and
yeah,
carried,
okay,
off the noble and the mighty man. And we'll see, that'll be very clear that this eagle is Nebuchadnezzar.
Right.
Now, another eagle is going to be mentioned,
uh-huh,
after,
okay,
verse 8, and that eagle is the Pharaoh, whom,
right,
the people of Judah had turned to for protection from the Babylonians.
Right. Okay, so Jehoiakim was the king in exile, as it were, in Babylon.
Yes.
And Zedekiah was the provincial king set up by Nebuchadnezzar, still in Jerusalem.
Yes, and he was the brother of Jehoiakim.
Right. Okay. Verse 5. He took also of the seed of the land and planted in a fruitful field. He placed it by great waters and set it as a willow tree. So, in other words, the people who were exiled, taken to Babylon, were placed in a fruitful land, and apparently they did farming work for the Babylonians, if we could take this very literally here. Verse 6.
Well, what we're going to see is the people that exceeded and did not resist the captivity which Yahweh decreed upon Judah would be allowed to flourish.
Right.
And that's what this represents.
Right.
Where the people that fled to Egypt to resist the captivity decreed by Yahweh.
Right.
That fled to Egypt and looked to the Pharaoh for salvation, those people would be in trouble.
Right. Right. And they would be destroyed, according to Jeremiah, and they were. Okay, verse 6. And it grew and became a spreading vine of low stature, whose branches turned toward him, and the roots thereof were under him. So it became a vine, and brought forth branches, and shot forth sprigs. Now, it's interesting that it's in the book of Maccabees, I believe, if not Josephus, where the exiled Israelites made an oath amongst themselves, saying, we will go into a further country, that is, on the other side of the Caucasus Mountains, and there we will keep the law as we never were able to keep it in Palestine, right?
Well, that's in that's in the apocryphal book that's often called Second Esdras, because that's what it's called in the King James Apocrypha.
Okay. But it's really
and it's a much disputed book. I accept the book for the most part the way it is. I wish we had a better Hebrew copy of it. A Hebrew copy of that book does not exist.
Okay. But anyway, this is a similar story here that under captivity, it seems like our people have to experience captivity in order to turn back to Yahweh.
Well, right.
So
and
when we're prosperous, we turn our backs to him. When we're unprosperous, we turn back to him.
Here we are again.
And
exactly. Don't let anybody think we're not in captivity now.
That's
just
right. We are definitely. Deuteronomy 28, the alien within us is lending to us, and we will not lend to him. He shall lend to us, and we are wage slaves and debt slaves for sure.
Well, when you look at your taxes, I mean, it's rumored every year that the average American works until May to pay the government.
Right. 40%.
And actually, it's a lot longer than that, because you don't see all of the hidden taxes pay in the price of every product you buy.
Right. Exactly. Okay, verse 7. There was also another great eagle with great wings and many feathers. And behold, this vine did bend her roots toward him and shot forth her branches toward him, that he might water it by the furrows of her plantation.
Now this represents the princes of Judah who looked to Pharaoh of Egypt for salvation. And many of them had gone into Egypt, where we see that Jeremiah was also compelled to go.
Right.
And that was probably divine providence that did that.
Right.
However, it was seen as a, you know, Yahweh told all those people that fled to Egypt that they would be in trouble for it.
Right. Well, they didn't settle in Egypt at any rate. They went further west, okay?
There's evidence that Jeremiah had gotten out of Egypt. There's no evidence of that in the Hebrew scripture, though, in the Bible.
Right. Okay, very good. Verse 9, say you, thus says Yahweh Elohim, shall it prosper? Shall he not pull up the roots thereof and cut off the fruit thereof that it wither? It shall wither in all the leaves of her spring, even without great power of any people to pluck it up by the roots thereof. So the people who decided to relocate to Egypt, that was a big mistake, and it didn't pan out. Verse 10, yea, behold, being planted, shall it prosper? Shall it not utterly wither when the east wind touches it? It shall wither in the furrows where it grew. And, of course, this east wind is the famous Sirocco of the Middle East, a very hot, dry wind that parches everything. And it's like sometimes it happens when the rainy season is supposed to begin. And if it happens at that time, it prolongs the summer and creates a tremendous drought. Okay, verse
Yeah, well, the Arab peoples, they make everything parched that they touch, too.
Right.
And I think it probably refers to the race mixing that was going to go on eventually, and those people would be bred out of existence.
Right.
The story about Egypt is also told in Jeremiah chapters 43 and 44,
uh-huh.
and again in Ezekiel chapter 30. I just wanted to make a note for anybody interested.
Okay, very good. All right, verse 11. Moreover, the word of Yahweh came to me, saying, say now to the rebellious house, know you not what these things mean? Tell them, behold, the king of Babylon has come to Jerusalem and has taken the king thereof and the princes thereof and led them with him to Babylon. And he has taken the king's seed, that is, his descendants, and made a covenant with him, and has taken an oath of him. He has also taken the mighty of the land. Now, here, the way this is, the rest of the verse is translated, it seems to interpret the word seed as singular.
Well, because the king's seed, it's of the king's seed.
Okay.
Okay?
All right.
So it can be singular. He took of the, in other words, he took a member of the king's family,
right,
and made a covenant with him.
So seed is not necessarily singular here with the...
Well, right, because we have the genitive.
Right.
He took of the king's seed.
Right.
Now, what we have here is this is the explanation of what how I already explained this parable, that first eagle is the king of Babylon come to Jerusalem, took Jehoiachin and the princes to Babylon,
right.
You know, the sons and the noble of Jerusalem and the mighty of the land. Well, which Ezekiel was one of those people.
Uh-huh.
Okay, Ezekiel himself is one of those people. Now the mighty of the land mentioned here.
Uh-huh.
Now the king's seed was the Zedekiah.
Right.
He took off the king's family and made a covenant with him. That's Zedekiah. And the covenant would be that Judah would pay homage and be subject to Babylon.
Right.
So I mean, that's the standard... That's the standard covenant that conquering nations made in the Eastern times with local kings. What we'll set, you know, Jehoiachin, it was made with Jehoiachin, but he rebelled, so they came and removed him and gave Zedekiah a shot.
Right.
And that was pretty standard to let a kingdom be more or less autonomous as long as they can pay up every year.
Well, the Romans did the same thing. They operated exactly the same way. They tolerated local religion. They tolerated local regions, but they were under their control.
Okay. Well, right. It's a lot easier to manage an empire that way.
Right.
But when you have compliant subject kingdoms.
Right.
I mean, look at the United States. Well, we don't hassle Japan. They do what we want.
Right.
We don't hassle South Korea or France or Germany. They're doing what we want. They're doing what the Rothschilds want.
Right, right. And,
but Iraq is not doing what the Rothschilds want.
Right, right. Neither is Afghanistan. So what they did in Afghanistan, they placed in the power of Mr. Karzai, who is one of the big executives of Arco Oil Company, right? They made sure they have an oil company executive as their provincial president in Afghanistan.
So it's going to be Arco Poppy and Seed.
Right. Oil, opium, and what else? What else do they have? That's about it. Oil and opium, right? The two O's, the big O's. Okay, verse 14, that the kingdom might be base, that it might not lift itself up, but that by keeping of his covenant it might stand. Okay,
the appointment of Zedekiah, the brother of Jehoiachin, who made a covenant that based, that humbled the kingdom, that made it base. It was now a subject kingdom.
Right.
All right, but the covenant with the Babylonians, as long as Zedekiah played the game and paid what was due, you know, the whatever Babylon decreed that he would pay every year.
Right, the covenant was tribute.
well, right, and that's exactly what it is.
Yes.
As long as they paid that every year, that the kingdom would stand.
Right, right. It's a protection racket, the age-old protection racket that the Jews turned into a street corner variety when they invaded New York City, right?
Well, right, exactly.
Yeah. Verse 15, but he rebelled against him in sending his ambassadors into Egypt, that they might give him horses and many people. Shall he prosper? Shall he escape that does such things? Or shall he break the covenant and be delivered? Of course, go ahead.
Yeah, that's a rhetorical question. Zedekiah broke the covenant with Babylon, and of course he's not going to be delivered.
Right, because he's already prophesied that it will not prosper. Verse 16, as I live, says Yahweh, surely in the place where the king dwells that made him king, whose oath he despised, and whose covenant he broke, even with him in the midst of Babylon shall he die. Okay.
So Zedekiah is to die in Babylon.
Right.
In captivity.
Verse 17, neither shall Pharaoh with his mighty army and great company make for him in the war, by casting up mounts or building forts to cut off many persons, seeing he despised the oath by breaking the covenant. When, lo, he had given his hand and has done all these things, he shall not escape. Okay, so he broke his oath, and he didn't listen to Yahweh's prophets, either Ezekiel or Jeremiah, who both told him that this is for Judah's good.
And you know, Herodotus reports a war. It's in my mind. I didn't look it up for this.
Uh-huh.
But Herodotus does report that there was a war between the Pharaoh Necho and the king of Babylon at this time, and the Syrians of Palestine, which is what Herodotus calls the people of Judea.
Okay. Yeah, okay. And whose side were the Syrians on?
Well, they were, evidently they were on Pharaoh's side, and it didn't work out too well.
Okay. Verse 19. Therefore, thus says Yahweh Elohim, as I live, surely my oath that he has despised and my covenant that he has broken, even it will I recompense upon his own head. And I will spread my net upon him, and he shall be taken in my snare, and I will bring him to Babylon, and will plead with him there for his trespass that he has trespassed against me. And all his fugitives with all his bands shall fall by the sword, and they that remain shall be scattered toward all the winds, and you shall know that I, Yahweh, have spoken it. Thus says Yahweh, I will also take of the highest branch of the high cedar, and will set it. I will crop it from the top of its young twigs, a tender one, and will plant it upon a high mountain and eminent. Now this is the twig that the British Israelites referred to as Tiatefi.
Well, right, and I don't know if I want to refer to this twig, if I want to accept the Tiatefi story as literally historical.
Okay.
Because I haven't seen good providence for it. I'm being honest with you.
Yeah.
But this surely indicates right here that somebody young from the royal house of Judah is going to escape Palestine and be planted where the mountain of the height of Israel is.
Yes.
There's no doubt that this is what this says.
Right.
And I'll have more notes when we finish. But well, first I want to say that this is a change in the topic from Zedekiah and his breaking of the covenant with
exactly.
the Babylonians.
Because there's three twigs, sets of twigs here. The first is Jehoiakim, the second is Zedekiah, and the third is the very tender twig that will be planted.
Well, right. This is definitely a distinct turn in the subject here.
Yes. Okay. So chapter 17 has three themes going here. Okay. And verse 23, and the mountain of the height of Israel will I plant it, and it shall bring forth boughs and bear fruit and be a goodly cedar, and under it shall dwell all fowl of every wing. In the shadow of the branches thereof shall they dwell, and all the trees of the field shall know that I, Yahweh, have brought down the high tree, have exalted the low tree, have dried up the green tree, and have made the dry tree to flourish. I, Yahweh, have spoken and have done it. So if we interpret this as Tiatefi and, of course, Scada as well, establishing the Zerah Judah branch, merging the Pharez Judah branch with the Zerah Judah branch of kingship in the west, this would be also a fulfillment of Ezekiel, I think it's in 37, where the at least a partial fulfillment or early fulfillment of the two houses or two branches, Zerah and Pharez, being joined up together in the future. Okay.
Well, right. I believe I have a few things to say about this.
Okay.
First, we see Jeremiah in. I'm going to be honest with you. I didn't look it up. I don't remember if it's Jeremiah 43 and 44, I think it is, or it's recorded in Chronicles. But in one place or the other, we see Jeremiah with the daughters of the king in Egypt.
Yes.
Okay, that's scripture. It's beyond doubt. We see here in Ezekiel 17:1, the first twig spoken about It is a, from the highest branch of the cedar, and that's clearly Jehoiachin.
Okay.
So this twig, being part of the same story and being of the highest of the highest branch of the high cedar.
Yes.
Okay. It's not the highest branch itself. It's of the highest branch.
Right.
Well, if Jehoiachin is the highest branch, then taking something of the highest branch must be just like taking something of Jehoiachin's seed,
right?
Which was his brother. So this also must be a member of the royal house.
Right.
Okay? It has to be. That's the only valid way to interpret this.
Yeah.
Israel here cannot be in Palestine.
Right.
By any means can Israel be in Palestine here.
Yes.
Now, this must be a reference, I would think, the high tree and a low tree, the dry tree and the green tree, must be a reference to Zarah Judah as compared to Pharez Judah.
Right.
Because the green tree, the tree has to represent Judah, okay?
Yeah.
The two trees have to be...
The scepter tribe, right?
Well, right. It has to be some... The dry tree has to be something which is set in opposition to and is a viable counterpart of the green tree.
Right.
And that's the only way this makes sense.
Yeah.
Is that
and for those people... who insist that trees and wood terminology must be taken literally.
well, right. Now, this dry
tree...
There's
no way they can understand this in any other way.
That this dry tree must already be associated with the dispersion of Israel.
Right, exactly.
So all these factors have to be in this interpretation.
Right.
And the only way, to me, it makes sense is if that the that this twig is replanted to the royal tribe
right.
in another land.
Okay, absolutely. Yes, Brutus does fit in because Brutus is of Zarah Judah, as are all the Trojans, as the Roman emperors are descendants of the Trojans. So were the Brits, okay? The British kings and queens were also descendants of Zarah Judah through the Trojans, okay?
Well, I would like to accept the Tefi story, okay?
Uh-huh. Okay.
I know... that as much as I have vociferated here from Scripture has to be true.
Right.
But I can't find, for the way the specifics of the Tefi story are, there is very little providence for.
Right.
Archaeological and ancient. Well, when I say providence, I mean proof that these stories existed at a very ancient time.
Right.
Yeah, you know, the records. Who filled these records in? Where did they get it from?
Right.
You see,
right.
And I'm always the skeptic when it comes to things like that. I always try to be careful, and I would be careful here also.
Right, certainly. Well, but the Irish Chronicles, they all refer, and even the Declaration of Arbroath declares.
Well, right, I understand that. But none of that goes back before 1000 A.D.
Right.
And McBragg is telling me he'll send me some info, but I don't have anything that actually goes back before 1000 AD.
Yes.
Now, I understand the Brutus story very well. I wrote classical records in Trojan, Roman, Judah, and it's mentioned in there.
Right.
And I've read Virgil, and that's found in Virgil, and Virgil wrote in the 1st century BC, which is still a long time after Troy. However, the movement of Trojans to Rome is recorded in all the ancient Greek historians. It's an innumerable cloud of witnesses to that, and it's the biblical evidence connecting the Trojans to Zarah Judah is found in 1 Kings chapter 4, and that's spelled out in my classical records in Trojan Roman Judah paper on Christogenia.
Right, right. And who's the identity travelogue guy? E. Raymond Capt. He documents all of this in his writings and in his videos as well.
Well, right. And this definitely indicates
a
transfer of the royal family to the dry tree, to Zarah Judah.
Right.
I'm fully convinced of that.
Yeah.
But I'm just a little hesitant to dive into the Tefi story because even the best evidence is not that old.
Right. Right. Well, yeah, the Declaration of Arbroath refers back to the days when the Scots were Israelites in Spain, and also there's even back to Egypt that the Arbroath document declares that the Scots originated in Egypt and through Spain.
Well, right.
So they understood who they were.
I also believe that even though all of the parties to the declaration of Arboeth are Israelites,
yes,
that the declaration itself reflects a slight confusion of history.
Sure.
And that's because I believe that the word Scot comes from Scythian, but the Aboriginal people of Ireland were never Scythians.
Uh-huh.
Okay? And that's
right.
It can be debated, but it can never be proven, right?
Right.
That the
right.
I believe the original inhabitants of Ireland and Britain, the original Britons, were Phoenicians,
right,
and the house of Zarajuda, which ruled over, as we have in Greek writers, and I cite Strabo at least for this, that the Trojans had all of the Phoenician colonies of the Mediterranean had taken Trojan princes for their kings.
Right. Right.
Way back as far back as the Trojan War.
Right, right.
And further back than that. So
yeah.
Judah Zara, it can be shown, ruled over the Phoenician, which were the northern tribes of Israel.
Right.
In the earliest dispersions.
Yes. Okay.
They were recognized as royalty.
Right, right. And the same is true of Pharaoh's Judah. In Mesopotamia, the various Israelite tribes under different names, such as the Parthians, the Scyths, the Sakae, etc., the Goths, or the Getae, whatever pronunciation, they took Pharaoh's Judah members for their kings. Okay? So we have.
Well, that's very plausible, yes.
Yeah.
There's a tribe of Scythians that the Greek writers called the Royal Scythians.
Okay.
They call them Royal Scythians for a reason.
Right. Probably because they were Pharaoh's Judah, right?
Well, I believe so, yes.
Yeah. Okay, very good. All right, chapter 18, verse 1. The word of Yahweh came to me again, saying, "What mean you that you use this proverb concerning the land of Israel, saying, 'The fathers have eaten sour grapes, and the children's teeth are set on edge'? As I live, says Yahweh, you shall not have occasion any more to use this proverb in Israel. Behold, all souls are mine."
Well, let me talk about this 18, 1 and 2 and 3 for a while,
okay,
before we move on. Because this is also seen in Jeremiah 31.
Okay.
We've already seen in chapter 16 a reference to the new covenant in Ezekiel.
Yes.
And here in Ezekiel 18, we see a direct reference a direct corroboration of, because they're not, one's not quoting from the other, they both wrote about the same time. Right.
Right.
Well, we see a direct corroboration of the prophecy in Jeremiah 31, verses 27 through 30, and I'd like to read that.
Okay.
"Behold, the days come, saith Yahweh, that I will sow the house of Israel and the house of Judah with the seed of man and with the seed of beast."
Uh-huh.
And this is talking about the future,
right,
and I believe it's talking about today.
Yes.
"And it shall come to pass that like as I have watched over them to pluck up and to break down and to throw down and to destroy and to afflict, so will I watch over them to build and to plant, saith Yahweh. In those days they shall say no more, 'The fathers have eaten a sour grape and the children's teeth are set on edge.'"
Yes.
Now this is the same thing that we see here in,
right,
Ezekiel 18:11. And Jeremiah goes on to say, "But everyone shall die for his own iniquity."
Uh-huh.
And we're going to see this is the same thing Ezekiel is going to go on to discuss as we continue through chapter 18.
Yeah.
Okay?
Okay.
And it says, "Every man that eats the sour grape, his teeth shall be set on edge."
Right.
And I believe that that's a reference to the race mixing,
sure,
that we have seen indicated. What, your mother is a Hittite, your father is an Amorite,
right,
in Ezekiel chapter 6.
Well, if you marry a Hittite, no sweet grapes come of that.
Well, right, it's sour grapes. Now I would like to quote Deuteronomy 32.
And they add a lot of sugar to Manischewitz.
Right.
To make it sweet.
I would like to quote, and that's Jewish wine, right?
Yes, right.
I would like to quote Deuteronomy 32, 31 to 34.
Yeah.
"For their rock is not as our rock."
Uh-huh.
even our enemies themselves being judges. In other words, the God of Israel is better than the non-gods of the heathens.
Right.
For their vine is of the vine of Sodom and of the fields of Gomorrah.
Right.
Their grapes are grapes of gall. Their clusters are bitter.
Right.
Their wine is the poison of dragons and the cruel venom of asps.
Yes.
If you want to know what the sour grapes are, it's the Canaanites and the Hittites and the mixed races.
Of Sodom.
And
yeah.
They are sour grapes.
That's right. Sodomites. They're Sodomites, for one thing, and many others as well. Yeah.
Now what we see,
et cetera.
Is we see, and I believe this is, you know, this ties in to what Paul talked about as far as boasting in genealogy is important.
Okay.
Our genealogy is important, but that we boast in it is not sufficient.
Right.
Because our genealogy alone is not sufficient. And we're going to see that coming up in
Yeah, and ironically, we've pointed this out in other contexts, that there was this trend. I think it began in the 50s, maybe a little earlier. Maybe it's due to all the cowboy movies that were being run, you know, in the 40s and 50s. But white people used to brag that they had Indian blood in them, right? And sometimes it was true, sometimes it wasn't. But here, you know, why do you want to brag about having Indian blood? What's the point of that? You know, you're an Anglo-Saxon. That's what you should be proud of, okay? Verse 5, but of course you don't gloat in it. You know, we should be proud of our heritage, but we don't go around gloating in it, because obviously we set ourselves up a fall when we do that. For a fall when we do that. Okay, verse 4. Behold, all souls are mine as the soul of the Father, so also the soul of the Son is mine. The soul that sins, it shall die. Okay?
Now let me just say that this word soul in these verses is 53:15. It's nefesh. And it means life. But wherever spirit is mentioned in the sense of that eternal spirit which Yahweh breathed into Adam, that's always Hebrew number 7307, ruach, which is literally breath.
Right.
I just wanted to make that distinction, because one has to be careful reading these verses.
Yes.
I don't believe, to confuse the inevitable punishment for sin in this life with judgment in the next life.
Yeah.
And our judgment is in this life, too. When we sin in this life, we will also suffer punishment for it in this
That's
life.
Exactly
we won't
right.
escape.
Yes, verse 5, but if a man be just, as you were just saying, and do that which is lawful and right, and has not eaten upon the mountains, this is talking about the groves, the Canaanite groves. Neither has lifted up his eyes to the idols of the house of Israel. Neither has defiled his neighbor's wife. Neither has come near to a menstruous woman, and has not oppressed any, but has restored to the debtor his pledge, has spoiled none by violence, has given his bread to the hungry, and has covered the naked with a garment. By the way, this is the faith of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, folks. That's what we're getting here. Verse 8. He that has not given forth upon usury, neither has taken any increase, that has withdrawn his hand from iniquity, has executed true judgment between man and man. It's not true that we're not supposed to judge. We're supposed to execute true judgment. And that's why Paul said we must put certain people out of our congregations, because they're committing evil. Verse 9, has walked in my statutes and has kept my judgments to deal truly. He is just. He surely shall live, says Yahweh. Very eloquent.
Well, right. And you know, these verses affirm all of the New Testament passages that tell us that if we love our brethren, by that we display our love for God.
Right.
You cannot, if you love the law and you love your brother, you can't break the law.
Right.
You won't covet his wife.
Right.
You won't covet his goods. You won't be choking him for usury on debt.
Right. and you won't be giving him hybrid seed from Monsanto.
Well, right, that too. And there's a whole long list of other crimes.
Right, yeah. It's really gone downhill rapidly the last few years. Verse 10, if he father a son that is a robber, a shedder of blood, and that does like to any one of these things, and that does not any of these duties, but even has eaten upon mountains and defiled his neighbor's wife. And this is almost verbatim, Matthew chapter 25, the latter half of Matthew chapter 25, the sheep and the goats, right? But we're talking about Israelites here specifically. and that does not any of those duties, but even has eaten upon the mountains and defiled his neighbor's wife, has oppressed the poor and needy, has spoiled by violence, has not restored the pledge, and has lifted up his eyes to the idols, has committed abomination, has given forth upon usury, and has taken increase, shall he then live? He shall not live.
And this seems to me to be taking criminal behavior,
right,
and attributing it to the father's eating sour grapes.
Right.
To genetic reasons.
Right, right.
That's, I mean, there's a direct correlation here.
Yes.
We go right from the father's eating sour grapes and the poison of dragons and everything that refers to in
right.
Deuteronomy, and we go right into fathers who can do well and sons doing evil. But we have vice versa and further on.
Yeah.
So
it
seems to be a little confusing, but.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, okay, has done all these things about he surely shall die, his blood shall be upon him. Of course, as you were saying that, I was thinking of the fact that Cain killed Abel. And it was because Cain had had genetic propensity for committing all these evil acts, including murder, okay? Because he did not consider Abel his brother. He did not consider him to be his brother. Verse 14. Now, lo, if he fathers a son that sees all his father's sins, which he has done, and considers and does not such like, that has not eaten upon the mountains, neither has lifted up his eyes to the idols of the house of Israel, has not defiled his neighbor's wife, neither has oppressed any, has not withheld the pledge, neither was spoiled by violence, but has given his bread to the hungry, and has covered the naked with a garment, that has taken off his hand from the poor, that has not received usury nor increase, has executed my judgments and walked in my statutes, he shall not die for the iniquity of his father. He shall surely live. So it can be turned around.
Well, it can be turned around, and I believe that's because not only are we punished for when we race mix, but we also are punished for when we follow the ways of the other races.
Right.
When we follow the ways of the Canaanites and the heathens, we become like them.
That's right. They never become like us. So it's a complete waste of time for us to try to convert them.
Well, a Negro could never be like a Saxon.
Right.
But there's a lot of Saxons out there today that act
Negro.
Just like Negroes,
yeah.
and think that they are.
Yeah. The leopard can't change its spots, and there's no way you could put the leopard in a monkey suit or hat and tails. It's not going to make him a Saxon. Right. Very good. Verse 18, as for his father, because he cruelly oppressed, spoiled his brother by violence, and did that which is not good among his people, lo, even he shall die in his iniquity. Yet say you, why? Why does not the son bear the iniquity of the father? When the son has done that which is lawful and right, and has kept all my statutes, and has done them, he shall surely live. The soul that sins, it shall die. The son that shall not bear the iniquity of the father, the son shall not bear the iniquity of the father, neither shall the father bear the iniquity of the son. The righteousness of the righteous shall be upon him. In other words, we all get our just deserts. And the wickedness of the wicked shall be upon him.
Well, this is evident that children suffer for the sins of
right.
the fathers.
Yes.
And Yahweh is promising here to break that pattern
right.
if a son shows himself worthy.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
And this is very much like the admonitions in earlier chapters that we've seen several times in Ezekiel, and I think we discussed it last week, that even a Noah, a Job, or a Daniel would not be able to save their own children, no matter
right.
how righteous they themselves were. And I believe that the purpose for this is that Israel as a nation was promised preservation
yes.
simply on account of the oaths which Yahweh swore to Abraham.
Yes.
And I believe that people,
right.
and that's what I tried to described before about genealogy, that people took that for granted.
Right.
But you shouldn't take your genealogy for granted. It's not good enough by itself to find yourself deemed righteous before Yahweh. You may be quote unquote saved because you bear the spirit of Adam.
Right.
But that doesn't get you anywhere.
Yeah.
When you face the judgment seat of Christ,
you have
been a wicked person.
Being white is not good enough?
Well, you're going to
be
punished for your actions. There's no doubt. You may exist and be there,
right.
but you're going to be punished for your actions.
Right. It's not a ticket. not a ticket to heaven, that's for sure. Verse 18, as for his father, because he cruelly oppressed, spoiled his brother by violence, and did that which is not good among his people, lo, even he shall die in his iniquity. Oh, I backed up, sorry. I ended up verse 20, now 21. But if the wicked will turn from all his sins that he has committed, and keep all my statutes, and do that which is lawful and right, he shall surely live. He shall not die. Now, how many times have we heard Yahweh speak in this manner, that if we obey his laws, we will not have any illnesses, we will not have any miscarriages, we will have peace and prosperity in our midst if we keep obeying his laws.
Well, right, and that's why I pointed out that this, yeah, you know, this word soul here or life here is nefesh. It means this physical life
right.
In this context, and that is, if you keep the laws of God, you'll
right.
live a healthy life.
Right, and we'll live at least to be 120 years old, and we'll be healthy for all that time, and we'll die a natural death, right, and not have be stuck in a nursing home being fed hot dogs and macaroni and cheese for the rest of our lives, right? Verse 22.
Fat Negroes.
Yes, right. All his transgressions that he has committed, they shall not be mentioned to him in his righteousness that he has done. He shall live. In other words, Yahweh will forget your sins if you truly repent. And, the New Testament is no different. Repent and be saved. But today, the churches just teach, be saved. They totally forget about the repent part. Okay?
Well, I believe that all of this is instruction to the Israelites of the captivity. Because the temple sacrifices could no longer be made once the temple was destroyed.
Yes, yes. Okay. Verse 23. Have I any pleasure at all that the wicked should die, says Yahweh, and not that he should return from his ways and live? Of course, he wants Israelites to return. Now, the parable of the prodigal son, it's every single Israelite, Yahweh wants him back. If that person is willing to repent, but only if that person is willing to repent. Verse 24, but when the righteous turns away from his righteousness and commits iniquity and does according to all the abominations that the wicked man does, shall he live? All his righteousness that he has done shall not be mentioned, and in his trespass that he has trespassed, and in his sin that he has sinned, in them shall he die. Yet you say the way of Yahweh is not equal. Hear now, O house of Israel, is not my way equal? Are not your ways unequal? He's consistent. We're not, right? Verse 26, when a righteous man turns away from his righteousness and commits iniquity and dies in them, for his iniquity that he has done shall he die. Okay? And, of course, this was another, when we talked in the book of Matthew where the Pharisees were always complaining that Jesus would heal people, okay? And then on one occasion, he said, I forgive you your sins, instead of, I heal you, okay? And then they haggled with him. Well, only God can forgive sins. And he said, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, right.
Verse 27, what don't you get, right? Verse 27, again, when the wicked man turns away from his wickedness that he has committed and does that which is lawful and right, he shall save his soul alive, okay? We all want that, don't we? We don't want eternal life under the present circumstances, though. We want freedom. We want true liberation. We don't want Jews running our country. We want Yahshua running our country. Verse 28, because he considers and turns away from all his transgressions that he has committed, he shall surely live. He shall not die. Yet, says the house of Israel, the way of Yahweh is not equal. O house of Israel, are not my ways equal? Are not yours always unequal? Therefore will I judge you, O house of Israel, everyone according to his ways. Repent and turn yourselves from all your transgressions, so iniquity shall not be your ruin. Can it be any clearer that Yahweh does not want us to sin? Yet, people who sin actually redefine sin so that it's not sin, okay?
Yes, they do. That's very common.
Right. So that the succeeding generation doesn't even know that it's wrong. And that's what's happening today. That's why we have such pervasive race mixing. Verse 31, cast away from you all your transgressions whereby you have transgressed, and make you a new heart and a new spirit. For why will you die, O house of Israel? For I have no pleasure in the death of him that dies, says Yahweh. Wherefore, turn yourselves and live you. In other words, convert yourself. Convert yourself back to Yahweh. Okay, chapter 19, verse
1. Now, the Jews have never, ever done that, and they never will.
They never will.
They did not accept Christianity.
That's right. That's right. And they never accepted Yahweh either. They just pretend to. Okay, verse 1, chapter 19. Moreover, take you up a lamentation for the princes of Israel and say, what is your mother? A lioness? She lay down among lions. She nursed her whelps among young lions. And she brought up one of her whelps. It became a young lion, and it learned to catch the prey. It devoured men. Of course, a whelp would be, is that exclusively a male, a young male, a whelp?
I believe so, but I can't be sure. Believe so.
Okay, verse 4. The nations also heard of him. He was taken in their pit, and they brought him with chains to the land of Egypt. Okay.
Which seems to be representative of Joseph.
Right, okay.
And the later captivity of Israel in Egypt.
Okay, now when she saw that she had waited and her hope was lost, then she took another of her whelps and made him a young lion, and he went up and down among the lions and became a young lion and learned to catch the prey and devoured men. And he knew their desolate palaces, and he laid waste their cities, and the land was desolate and the fullness thereof by the noise of his roaring. Then the nation set against him on every side from the provinces and spread their net over him. He was taken in their pit. And they put him in a ward of chains, and they brought him to the king of Babylon. They brought him into holds that his voice should no more be heard upon the mountains of Israel. So unless there's a reference back to Jehoiakim here.
Well, I believe so.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, he's a descendant of that leadership that first went to Egypt.
So a whelp would be, in the metaphorical language here, a very young king, okay, a young king. And they put him in a ward of chains. They brought him to the king of Babylon, and they brought him into holds that his voice should no more be heard upon the mountains of Israel. Your mother is like a vine in your blood, planted by the waters. She was fruitful and full of branches by reason of many waters. Okay, what's the many waters here? Because are we talking about the 12 tribes? Your mother is like a vine in your blood. That's kind of an unusual expression. But if we're sticking to pure blood, it can only be Israelites. Planted by the waters, and the waters would be the Tigris and Euphrates, right?
Well, the brought him to the king of Babylon, and they brought him into holds that is what, thy mother is like a vine in thy blood, planted by the waters. She was fruitful and full of branches by reason of many waters.
Okay.
And she had strong rods for the scepters of them that bear. The mother is the nation. It has to be.
Yes.
And the many waters are not, well, the many tribes of Israel, but also probably the many tribes that at one time Israel ruled over.
Yes, okay. Yeah, okay. For the scepters of them that bore rule, and her stature was exalted above the thick branches, and she appeared in her height with the multitude of her branches. Of course, under David and Solomon, the nation of Israel was made extremely famous. Probably, no other kingdom in the territory was as famous as Israel in those days. Okay,
well,
or powerful.
There's a long blackout in Greek history.
Okay.
Okay, and we know very little of what's happening in Anatolia during that period.
Right.
Carthage was founded in that period. Thessaly was settled by Phoenicians in that period. That was the Dorian period, where the Dorians conquered the Peloponnese. The Iberian Peninsula was founded. That's the ships of Tarshish really went to Tarshish.
Right.
I mean, that was Tarsus in southern Spain.
Uh-huh.
And I believe that during that 400 years, which is a veritable blackout in Greek history, actually it's more like 500 years, that we have little writing of. And when the Greeks start writing around the 7th century, after the deportations of the Assyrians, that's when the Greeks start writing. They're writing about things that happened 500 and 600 years before.
Yes.
They're not writing much at all about the period in between.
Uh-huh.
The Greeks of 600 BC, Homer, Hesiod, and their followers, Archilochus and the elegiac poets, yeah, all of these people, when they wrote about historical events, they wrote about Troy.
Yeah.
1185 BC.
Right.
They wrote about the Dorian invasion. Maybe 1100 BC.
Uh-huh.
But they don't write about anything again up until the Persian Wars.
Right.
There's some of the events of the 5th and 6th centuries that they write nothing about the 10th century, the 9th century, the 8th century. We know nothing.
Yes. Well,
why wouldn't these people write about that time?
Yeah.
But that's the time of the kingdom years of Israel.
Right.
And I believe that Israel ruled over the Mediterranean at that time.
Okay.
It can't be proven because it's not written about.
Right.
But Yahweh said Israel would be blind.
Right.
What else accounts for that?
Right.
What else accounts for these brilliant, intelligent Greek poets not mentioning 400 years?
Right. Well, I mean, they could have been under Phoenician, which would be Israelite dominance.
Well, that's northern Israel.
Okay. Yes. Yes. Okay. And that would explain it. You know, it'd be hard to prove it, but that would explain the lack of historical writing during that period, because they were under Israel's command, so to speak, at that time.
Well, there was a fellow, I'd like to say that his name was Menander. I'm not 100% positive anymore. It's been a while since I read it. Josephus quotes him at length,
okay,
in Against Appian, and he quotes the Chronicles of Tyre. And they would be invaluable.
Yeah.
He translated the Chronicles of Tyre,
okay,
from the Phoenician Hebrew language they must have been written in,
yeah,
into Greek.
Oh, okay.
And Joseph has had them.
Yeah.
And they're gone now.
We don't. Okay.
They would be invaluable. They would be, for Tyre, they would be what the Book of Kings is to Judea, to Jerusalem.
So in other words, we're familiar with the economic or a seafaring history of the Phoenicians, but we don't really know much about their political alliances and what kind of possible military occupation they were capable of having. We don't know anything about that.
Well, right, but yeah, we have a Greece that's contained,
yeah,
and we know that a lot of the Greeks came from Israelite tribes,
right,
the Danans, the Dorians. We have a Greece that's contained for 400 or 500 years,
yes,
and we have in the Persian period, and this can be proven, a Carthage that still has allegiance to Tyre.
Okay.
And because Tyre was paying tribute to the Persian kings and was basically subject to the Persian kings, it was Tyre that built the Persian navy, which,
okay,
the Greeks destroyed in the Peloponnesian War. But
okay,
when the Persians invaded Greece at the same exact time the Phoenicians of Carthage invaded Sicily.
Uh-huh.
And Sicily and southern Italy at the time were referred to as Magna Graecia, or Greater Greece.
Uh-huh.
There were more Greeks in Sicily and southern Italy than there were
in Greece proper.
In Greece.
Yeah.
So what that did was it totally prevented, and many of those Greeks were all Spartans and Athenians, it totally prevented the Greeks of the great cities of Messenia and Syracuse and Magna Graecia from coming to the assistance of their brethren against the Persians.
Uh-huh. Okay. Okay. So there was the Persian invasion and probably a Phoenician occupation, which affected Greek writing.
Well, right. I believe so. That the Phoenician, or possibly the rule of David and Solomon and,
uh-huh,
their
yeah,
influence in the Mediterranean, because there are many Phoenician settlements and Phoenician peoples in Anatolia, Cilicia, Caria, and in Thessaly and in Gaul, what we know today is,
yeah,
Gaul, and in Iberia, and I believe that Solomon and or Hiram, or Hiram and or Solomon, and the subsequent kings had a great deal of influence or even rule over those regions,
yes,
as colonies that we don't have recorded in the Chronicles of,
right,
Kings.
Okay, well, if what you're saying is true, and I don't doubt it at all, it's all very plausible, there would be manifest a change in the language of Greece from before and after. I would anticipate a lot more Hebrew words, if not some Hebrew.
Well, there are a lot of Hebrew words in Greek. I mean, the Greek word for market is agora, and the Hebrew word for market is agora.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, there are a lot of Hebrew words.
No wonder I have agoraphobia.
well, right. But in Koine Greek, I don't see a large number of Hebrew words, but that's because we have Athenian had a great impact on the language known as Greek.
Okay.
And when you go back in time to other writers in other periods, I can read the biblical Greek very fluently and hardly have to refer to a lexicon, where I could pick up Hesiod's Greek, I could make out the grammar, but I have to be in a lexicon every other word for the vocabulary because it's so much different.
It's a big change then. Okay.
Well, right. There's a big change in the vocabulary between the 7th century B.C. and the the New Testament period.
Right.
That there's of course, there's a lot of words that are still common, but there's a large change in the vocabulary.
Right.
I believe that Greek is probably several dialects that were actually confounded and molded together. The Greek is a bastard language.
Yes. Oh,
okay. Now there's dialectual differences all the way through the Koine period, but there's bigger differences in vocabulary between the earlier times and the later.
Yes, and I know there's a lot of evidence of Hebrew influence on the Greek language during this time period. That alone would make a fascinating study. Okay.
Well, it is a fascinating study, and I'm of the persuasion that the Greek alphabet and the Greek language began to be formulated as early as Cyprus with Linear A and Linear B, that they are a sort of post-Hebrew proto-Greek.
Right.
At least Linear B is, right?
Right, right. Yeah, and it's been demonstrated that most of the alphabets, you know, the people have been falsely led to believe that Phoenician preceded Hebrew. And that's simply not possible.
Well, you know something? There was a discovery very recently in Jerusalem of an inscription from a Canaanite king from before the time of David.
Right.
And it dates to the 15th century B.C.
Yeah.
And it supports everything I've always said about the Levant because it was in cuneiform.
Okay.
It was in cuneiform.
Beautiful.
And it's before David's occupation of Jerusalem. And it's in cuneiform. And wherever you see inscriptions found in Palestine, which predate the Hebrews, you'll see them in cuneiform.
Okay.
You won't ever see them in Hebrew Phoenician letters.
Okay.
Phoenician letters and Hebrew letters are one and the same. They're not found in Palestine until the conquest of Joshua.
Right.
They're the same language.
The Israelites took over the territory. Yeah.
The Canaanites of Sidon wrote in cuneiform.
Uh-huh.
When the Israelites drove them out and took their city, we see Hebrew. We see the Phoenician alphabet appear.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, Phoenician is definitely derived from Hebrew, not the other way.
Well, they're one and the same.
Yeah, well.
They're one and the same. And there's several variants slight variants in the alphabet in diverse places.
Yes.
And sometimes it's written right to left, and sometimes it's written left to right, and sometimes it's written boustrephedon, which means that line one will be written right to left, and line two left to right, line three right to left, and line, because they wrote across the tablet and then just dropped down a line and wrote the other way back across the tablet.
I should try that. Maybe I could just get rid of my dyslexia.
Boustrephedon actually means as the cow turns.
Right, basically. Back and forth.
When you have a bull on a plow.
Exactly.
And you're plowing a field, you don't plow one row and then walk all the way back and plow another row, right?
Right, right, exactly. Very good. Verse 11. And she had strong rods for the scepters of them that bore rule, and her stature was exalted among the thick branches. And she appeared at her height with the multitude of her branches. So I think that verse is talking about, I think you're right, about the Phoenician Hebrews. And because even Solomon's ships are reputed to have come as far as America. Okay.
Well, I believe that the Phoenicians surely came as far as America. I don't know if they were always under the rule of Solomon when they made long journeys like that, but there's no doubt the Phoenicians navigated a great deal of the globe.
Yes.
And I probably think that our Israelite Phoenician, or maybe even before that, some of the Egyptians,
yes,
okay, from before the time of the Exodus, when Egypt was an empire and extended her reach to various parts of the Mediterranean,
yes,
that they actually were responsible for the higher cultures of South America, of the
okay,
the Aztec region, the Yucatan, that's the word I'm looking for.
Right.
But the Mexico and South America.
Right.
The Phoenicians or the Egyptians who preceded them were responsible for that.
Yeah, there was cross-Atlantic trade going on. Yeah.
Well, absolutely. There's all kinds of Phoenician artifacts in America. There's all kinds of Celtic and Norse artifacts or Viking artifacts.
Yes.
If I could call them Viking artifacts, that the in America, but the Celtic and Phoenician artifacts seem to be cut off with the coming of the Romans.
Yeah. Right. Very good. Okay, verse 12. But she was plucked up in fury. She was cast down to the ground, and the east wind dried up her fruit. Her strong rods were broken and withered. The fire consumed them. Okay, so we could be picturing Phoenicia and Solomon both here, verse 13. And now she is planted in the wilderness in a dry and thirsty ground. And fire has gone out of a rod of her branches, which has devoured her fruit, so that she has no strong rod to be a scepter to rule. This is a lamentation and shall be for a lamentation. Of course, when the Israelites, the house of Israel was taken captive and the house of Judah both taken captive, there was no, the scepter still existed, but they were paying tribute to Babylon and Assyria. Okay?
Now, when we cover Ezekiel chapters 27 and 28, we're going to see this all over again.
Uh-huh.
And probably in much greater detail,
okay,
that we talk about the nature of ancient Tyre.
Yeah, okay. Well, chapter 20 is another long chapter, 49 verses. Let's get into it, and we'll have to pick it up next time. Chapter 20, verse 1. And it came to pass in the seventh year, the fifth month, the tenth day of the month, that certain of the elders of Israel came to inquire of Yahweh and sat before me.
Now this seventh year has to be, as Ezekiel says at the beginning of his book, it's the fifth year of the captivity of Jehoiachin, and he must still be using that same method of dating for this chapter.
Right.
So we see that right here it's about 590 BC.
Okay, 2 years after the fifth year of Jehoiachin's captivity.
Right, and 4 years before, or 3.5 years perhaps before Jerusalem is destroyed.
Okay, verse 2. Then came the word of Yahweh to me, saying, Son of man, speak to the elders of Israel and say to them, Thus says Yahweh, are you come to inquire of me? As I live, says Yahweh, I will not be inquired of by you. Okay? Because you are evil priests, you are evil elders. Will you judge them, son of man? Will you judge them? Cause them to know the abominations of their fathers. And say to them, Thus says Yahweh, in the day when I chose Israel, I lifted up my hand to the seed of the house of Jacob and made myself known to them in the land of Egypt when I lifted up my hand to them, saying, I am Yahweh your Elohim. And, of course, I think we have more evidence that the children of Israel did not know the name of Yahweh until Mount Sinai. Okay.
Well, right, but I believe that there were elders from before the time of Abraham,
right,
that may have known it.
Yeah.
The name is known in Mesopotamia,
right,
in lands that I believe belonged to Hebrews.
Yes.
Now, I mean, Ugarit is often mentioned as a Canaanite city, but it may have been under the rule of Canaanites, and especially the Hittites, who are Canaanites, during their empire years.
Yeah.
But I believe that Ugarit was probably a truly Hebrew city.
Okay.
I believe it was probably part of the original Hebrew land of Arphaxad.
Okay.
Or Aram, and Aram, yeah, you know, that Syria is Aram. We see that Padan Aram is in northern Syria today, and it's the land of Aram extended down to Damascus, and they were all Shemitic people who were all white.
Yeah.
They were clearly white in ancient history, and they were clearly related to the Hebrews.
Right.
And in to prove that they're white, I'll quote Strabo, the geographer, who there was a group of Syrians, there was a tribe of Syrians that are sometimes called Cappadocians, who were called by the Greeks white Syrians.
Okay.
And Strabo, the geographer, who lived around the turn of the millennium, you know, he died in 25 AD.
Uh-huh.
Well, he said, he was talking about these white Syrians, and he said, I don't know why they call them white Syrians, as if there were actually any black ones.
Right.
And I'm paraphrasing, but that's what he said.
Right.
So by that we know there certainly weren't any black Syrians
right. That
Strabo considered all the Syrians to be white.
Right. Well, I think in certain cultures and possibly certain cities within a given country or territory, there may have been different attitudes toward the sun, okay? So that the white Syrians may have had, especially the women, would not go out in sunlight, and their skin would not get tanned, and they would look very, very white. In fact,
that could very well be because the Cappadocians were north of the Mediterranean
right. In
what would be eastern Turkey today in Anatolia.
Okay.
Okay. And that's a mountainous, rugged territory, and where the Greeks and the Romans and the Phoenicians always worked outdoors naked.
Yeah.
And that's why the men in their artwork are depicted as having very deep tans usually.
Yeah. Right.
Where the woman who spent all their time with their clothes on and in the house
right.
always had lily white skin
that's
in the artwork.
That's why they were called fair.
Right. But the
exactly.
Xenophon and he's writing about 380 BC perhaps.
Yes.
Xenophon remarked on the Persians that their skin was lily white
uh-huh.
because they always wore their robes.
Right.
They never took their robes off.
Yeah.
Where the Greeks would take their clothing off to work
uh-huh.
and
right.
and therefore working outdoors on their farms, on their ships,
right.
they would get deep tans.
Yeah, right. So the ones who actually wore their clothes while they became rednecks.
and that quote
because that's the only part of their body that was exposed to the sun. Right.
Right. And that quote's in Xenophon's Anabasis, but I don't have it handy.
Uh-huh. Yes, yes. But there was also a tradition in the ancient world in regard to fertility, and there may be some truth to it, that women who work out and do physical labor and get hot and sweaty in the sun and stuff, their fertility rate drops. It has something to do with the hormones created from all this excess physical labor, okay? And so in order to increase a woman's fertility, she would get out of the sun. And just, but maybe that just means laying around the house. You know, the more you lay around in the house, the more together you are in the same bed, right? Maybe that's all there is to that. But there is an ancient legend, you know, that getting too much sun for women affected their fertility. Okay.
Well, the Greeks, I think, kept their women in the house because they were very prone to disappearing. they were kidnapped. Kidnapping
right.
was very, very common in the ancient world.
Yeah.
In fact, you know, if you read the opening chapters of Herodotus, he blames the whole war with the Persians on the Phoenicians. He said it all started with them when they swept up in their ships and kidnapped someone.
And they blamed it on the Persians?
that's kidnapping set off another reciprocal kidnapping.
Right.
And that set off the Trojan taking of Helen. Yeah, you know, and
right.
Herodotus just traces the whole problem. Herodotus draws a picture of East versus West.
The Hatfields and the McCoys and
right. And he draws this picture of East versus West.
Right.
But he basically attributes it all to the kidnapping of women.
Right.
And he must have believed
wife?
It.
Honey, where's my dinner? Has anybody seen my wife? Right.
Well, right. But the kidnapping of women was very common on those islands in the Mediterranean in the ancient world. There's no doubt.
And you know what? It still is today. White women get kidnapped in enormous numbers in the Middle East. Okay, and they become sex slaves in the state of Israel. And I know a couple of people to whom that has happened. Okay, the tourists in Egypt. And if you go to Egypt or Israel or any of those Middle Eastern countries, and you have a fair young teenage girl, you keep a very close eye on her, because she will disappear. If you take her to a store and go from one room to another room in that same store and leave your daughter behind, you'll be lucky if you see her again. That's the way it is. It's still that way even today.
Well, the women are kept under wraps, and I have firsthand information from my own son, you know, that who did two tours of duty in Iraq.
Okay.
And spent a lot of time breaching buildings, because that was his job.
Yeah.
That he said that every other building they breached, they'd find the men in bed with little boys.
Wow.
Because the girls were kept under wraps and off limits.
Wow. Amazing. What a country. Jeez.
Well, what a religion. That's Islam.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's really the same as happening all over the world. Every religion is phony. The priesthoods of all these different religions, Judeo-Christianity included, they do not practice what they preach. Okay? And it's really a cesspool behind. Just look at the Catholic Church. Behind the scenes, it's a cesspool.
Absolutely.
That's right. None of these religions actually obey the dictates of their own religions.
Well, there's an Anglican priest just got pulled over for marrying like 360 phony marriages. And his entire parish is inhabited by people who he married off in phony marriages, who sometimes the same... And most of it was Negroes,
right?
Eastern Europeans.
It sounds
looking
like a
to
David
get into
Koresh.
England. Well, right.
Yeah,
and he'd take these Negroes and marry them. This article said that, and this was a mainstream media article, right?
Yeah.
And this article said that in some cases, several people were being married to the same person just to get them into England.
Right. Amazing. Immigration by religious conversion.
Yeah, right. That's an Anglican priest for you, destroying
Amazing.
England. Just like the Catholics here are some of the largest proponents behind us being flooded with these Mexicans.
Right, right.
So they can fill their pews. They can't fill their pews. They've been lying to us for centuries, molesting our children for centuries.
Yes.
And now they're upset we won't go to their churches.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, people are leaving. People are leaving mainstream Judeo-Christianity. They're certainly the young people aren't going to church. I don't see any young people going.
They should knock down the bricks, the stones of all these churches, and use them to build a damn wall in Mexico.
That's right. That's absolutely right. Okay. Well, I think, let's wrap it up here. And maybe next time we'll just begin with chapter 20, because we only got four verses into it. We'll take it from there, okay?
Praise Yahweh.
All right. Thank you, William Fink. This has been a very interesting walk through Israelite history, not Jewish history, folks, Israelite history. We, the Anglo-Saxon, Celtic, and Caucasian people, we are the Israelites of the Bible. The Jews are imposters. Anybody who tells you that the Jews are Israel is an idiot, a fool, or a Jew.
Absolutely.
Because they want you to believe that.
There's
right?
No doubt about it.
Yes. All right. Thank you very much. Thanks for listening. Praise Yahweh.